So,
what's trending?
Bridging your Catholic faith with your everyday life. You're listening to Trending with Timory on Relevant Radio.
Welcome to our weekly happy hour here on Trending. Have you ever missed a family moment or been there, but you missed it because you watched it through your phone, perhaps? Do you have any regret? Has it been something you look back on, you know, I really just wish I was there? I would love to hear from you, maybe what that moment was, what was going on through your mind, and then how you reflected on it later. Give us a call. The number is 1-888-914-9149. Again, have you ever missed a family moment because you watched it through your phone, recording it, taking the photo, but perhaps not quite being as present? You're listening to Trending with Timory. We're talking about happiness today on Trending. And we're going to be joined in just a little bit by Dr. Carrie Gress. She's the author of a number of books, including Theology of Home series, as well as The Anti-Mary Exposed, among others. And we're going to talk about, gentlemen, you don't have to ditch us because there's a purpose to this conversation. Can decorating and gardening, or fill in the blank, whatever your hobbies, home hobbies might be, tinkering with the car, whatever it is, can all of these things actually make us happy? We'll also discuss how living on the surface impacts our happiness. And we'll also dive into this topic of how on earth do I quit sugar? How do you quit it? How do you stop eating it? Are you addicted? Most of us are addicted to sugar. So we'll talk about that and much more today on Trending. Don't go away. So back in 2012, was it? 2013, Pope Benedict steps down. We're at the conclave, and I happen to be traveling through Europe during the conclave of the cardinals, waiting to find out who would be our next pope. And we're hoping, just hoping, perhaps we would be to Rome in time, because the end location was Rome, in time for the end of the conclave and therefore the inauguration of the new pope. Well, we showed up. We were in Roscarbery at the end of the inauguration. That's in Ireland. We traveled from France into Rome just as he was inaugurated, and it was eerie. We landed on the streets just a couple hours after his inauguration. I mean, we missed it by that much. But we were there for his very first public masses for the Easter season. In fact, the person right in front of me, the very first time someone was lifted up in a wheelchair to be blessed by the Pope as he brings them up to him, was actually right next to me. I have my own photos of that moment, along with moments where for the first time the Pope was jumping out of the Pope mobile and walking around and people didn't know what to do. And I'll never forget, though, as this was all happening, at one point, the Pope was reaching into the vicinity of where I'm standing now. He wasn't quite close enough. I thought about jumping over the barricade to try and touch our new Pope at the time, Pope Francis. I really kind of thought about it. I refrained. I even ditched some of my friends because I was pondering, what could I do to try and touch the Pope at the moment? And yeah, I was fangirling. You can fangirl the Pope, okay? So here I am, though, in a few feet away from me, there is this woman, and the Pope is reaching out, trying to bless her and touch her on the head. And the woman has a giant iPad in front of her face, and she's leaning backward away from the Pope, trying to get a photo of him as he's trying to reach over this giant iPad to bless her. It was a moment I will never forget. Because here the Pope is trying to bless this woman, place his hand on her head and bless her. And she's literally leaning backward, trying to take the photo of the moment. I don't even know if she was aware that he was trying to bless her. Because she was so wrapped into the idea of a photo. Perhaps he was blocking the camera with his hand. Maybe he really wasn't trying to bless her. I'm kidding. He was definitely trying to bless her. But it has, for years now, made me ponder, what have we missed, perhaps? What joy and what memories have been lost because of our need to take a photo? And I'm living this in a whole new way right now as I have a little baby. You know, everything babies do seems cute, at least to the parents. So you want to take a million photos of everything, every outfit, every headband in my case. And I have to remember that as she does something really cool, hold on, just pay attention. Don't run for the camera. Participate. For example, when she rolled over for the first time about a month ago, my husband went to run and grab the camera and said, no, just watch. Let's do it again. Do it a couple more times and we'll get a photo in just a bit. And that's okay. That is okay. And I have to remind myself every single day, multiple times throughout the day. Because I really do believe that our lack of presence due to our attempt to make a record of everything, although technology is great, it's become a distraction. And so I want to hear from you. Have you ever missed a family moment? Maybe you don't remember, recall a memory because you watched it through a phone, and the only way you could remember that memory was by looking at the photo. Now, there are two things here. Side by side, one might say, I documented the memory with a photo so that I wouldn't forget about it. But on the other end, sometimes there are moments where I see a photo and I'll say, I don't even remember that. And I think it's because perhaps I was too busy trying to take the photo. And so is this desire for photographing everything really just a distraction, or are we just very distractible? And how many photos, when you think about it, do you take of places you go, capturing the landscape? And then have you ever gone through your phone a month later, 2 weeks later, maybe 3 years later, and deleted a million ugly landscape photos? Yeah, why? Because it can't actually capture the moment. It can't actually capture the visual. And don't get me wrong, there's a lot that can be done with live photos and videos. It's incredible. But I notice in my own life, and especially that moment, we had that new pope, the story I just shared with you, and the woman's literally leaning away trying to take a photo with her giant iPad in her face while the pope's trying to bless her, and he doesn't get to touch her. He never blesses her with his hand. She leans so far back, she completely missed the opportunity. So I was thinking about this as I was pondering kind of the philosophy of distraction. And when we talk about distraction, often we should understand it more so as the idea of diversion. And diversion, by the philosopher Pascal, it really refers to anything that distracts ourselves from ourselves, essentially. So that's a diversion. If we're distracted from something other than who we are, what we are. A diversion depends on what we're supposed to be doing. So who we are in the moment of what we're experiencing. So for example, you really should have been blessed by the Pope, the Vicar of Christ in that moment. And yet we were participating in this diversion of a photo because we thought that's what we wanted. We thought that's what we needed. But this brings up the whole idea of how diversions and distractions play a role in our lives. Perhaps listening to music and cooking, gardening, watching the basketball game, fixing up a car, whatever it might be for you, working on a remodel in your home, perhaps there's a distraction, or might I say a diversion for you. But ultimately, the goal of any diversion, if it's a good diversion, wouldn't really mean that it was a diversion if it was orienting you toward a deeper sense of contemplation, of pondering not just the things in life that you're experiencing, not just thinking through things, but pondering who you are, what you're made for, who God is, and what God created you for. And often I find that a lot of our actual diversions, such as watching TV, listening to music, always having to check social media or take a photo and look back on those photos, aren't good because they're drawing us further away from ourselves and away from God ultimately. And I think this is important for us to ponder as we live in a world where media and technology will only continue to be a greater part of our lives. But you and I have to figure out, how do we balance it? How do we stay happy? How do we remain present? And at the end of the day, how do we make sure that we're not running from who we are and the God who created us, who is speaking to us, even through our hobbies, if they're hobbies that are allowing us to ponder him? You're listening to Trending with Tim Ray. We're going to dive deeper into this topic here today during our happy hour. We'll be talking about things such as living on the surface and Can that actually be a problem? What does it mean to just live on the surface? We'll unpack that and so much more. My guest joining me now is Dr. Carrie Grash. She's the author of a number of books, including Theology of Home series, as well as the Anti-Mary Exposed, just to name a few. When I was thinking about this topic of distraction and diversion, she's a perfect person. Her PhD is in philosophy, I believe. And as we're talking about this, you wrote a book that touched on the first Theology of the Home book, so much on the idea of decorating and gardening. And can these things in and of themselves actually make us happy?
I think that's a great question. one certainly that will be great to talk about. Thanks so much for having me on.
It's great to have you back, Dr. Grass. Let's talk about it. So in your first book, Theology of the Home, you dove quite a bit into decorating the home, creating, mm-hmm. Moments of silence, of peace, of joy. You mm-hmm. bridged together the idea that this turn toward decorating and knitting actually had a deeper meaning. So what does mm-hmm. this have to yeah. do with our happiness?
Yeah, no, I think that this is a great question and one that our culture is really struggling with. It might even be unwittingly, but I think we have this desire to have a beautiful home. We also want our homes to feel like a sanctuary. I think for a long time, our homes have sort of felt more like a familiar hotel. People are just sort of rushing in and out, and it's just this platform to sort of launch the rest of your life from. But it's not as important as it has become really in the last year with all the lockdowns and everything because of the virus. So it's been an interesting time to have written a book about home and going deeper. The book doesn't really talk about the how-tos. We don't have a lot of tips and things like that in the book, but it's more a question of why? Why do we want to decorate our homes and sort of look into that deeper desire that it's almost universal. People have this longing for home and especially women, even a perfect home. And where's that come from? So our answer really is just to say that it's meant to be a foretaste of heaven. This is what our homes are meant to be. And it's almost, we have this desire for a perfect home, but that's God's way of sort of drawing us closer to him, because the real perfect home, of course, is heaven. We want it on earth. And of course, we can only have it to such a degree. But that doesn't mean that we can't have a foretaste of it, and we can't put things in place in our lives that help bring all those, with whom we live to heaven with us. But at the same time, experience a foretaste of heaven in our own homes. So that's kind of the basic gist of the first Theology of Home book, was that idea that our homes really are meant to be a place that draws us onto heaven, and that, we need to be purposeful about what we're placing in our homes and how we're engaging with them, so that it feels like that foretaste, and it's not a foretaste of hell, because we know that that certainly can be the case and is the case for so many people in their homes today as well.
That placement of things and decorating the home, I think, is so important as we realize why there's such a need for perfectionism or mm-hmm. constant need to change things. But on mm-hmm. the other end of the spectrum is also the action of making the home, especially for women. So many people are engaging in knitting, they're engaging in gardening more than ever. We're seeing mm-hmm. more people who are homesteading, all the different mm-hmm. things. And people are saying for the first time, wow, I didn't know I like doing dishes so much, or laundry. It's so funny sometimes uh-huh. to hear that. I'll never forget a year or so ago, I had a client whose daughter moved in with her boyfriend, and she said, I have never seen my daughter so happy. And I paused thinking, oh, that's a bold statement after she just shared that. And I said, why is that? She said, because she stopped working and she's cooking mm-hmm. every day. She's cleaning. She's decorated the house. She said, mm-hmm. I didn't even know my daughter liked these things. Well, she was she was so close to what she fully wanted. She was missing the fact that she wanted a permanent relationship there as well. Mm-hmm. But the fact that she was taking so much joy and caring for the home and nurturing someone else, I think really stood out as how the function of doing things, the action as well, allows us for a deeper understanding of ourselves too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think that that's an excellent point. And it is fascinating to look at how all of these things like gardening and knitting and whatnot, really, even before COVID, they were making a comeback. And you know, sourdough breads and all kinds of things, just only were heightened by our time at home. So you can see really a blessing in that, in terms of reminding us that the home doesn't make itself, that it needs a homemaker. You know, that's why we're called homemakers, because we make the home. It's not just meant to be a place to store things, including people. And that's really what our second book goes into, Theology of Home Too, the spiritual art of homemaking, all of kind of the more the woman behind the home. But a lot of this makes sense if you really understand what a woman is. And this is one of the things that the more I talk to women, I realize, you know, we have just been bereft of an understanding of who we are for like 50 years now, because we've spent so much time trying to compete and compare ourselves with men that we don't really even know what it means to say that I'm a woman. And you know, there's actually some funny clips out there. If you ask, you know, someone went to the women's march and said, well, what is a woman? And you know, the responses are just ridiculous and hilarious at the same time. But I don't know that the rest of us do much better, because we just haven't really thought about what it means to be a woman. And so that was a really fun aspect to go into, in a lot of my work, is to just look at, what does it mean to be a woman? And, you know, much of it has to do with it, like the answer is already kind of written in our body, where we have wombs and we have a pelvis to carry children, and our arms are bent slightly differently than men so that we can cradle a baby. And, you know, we nurture children with our breast milk, and, you know, all of these things are sort of telling, but what are they telling us? Well, they're pointing to the fact that women carry things, we hold things. And if you think about the women that you love the most, you know, you hold them in your heart and they hold you in their heart. Your children are held in your heart. You know, and the men you love, you know, everyone around us that we know and love, we hold in our hearts. And, you know, we hopefully don't just carry them, but we improve them. And that's, I think, one of the beautiful things that women have forgotten about themselves, is we have this capacity to transform things for the better. And there's that great quote, I'm probably going to butcher it, by St. Edith Stein, where she talks about, the woman is a shelter, mm-hmm. so that other mm-hmm. souls can unfold in her. They're allowed to grow in her. So then, you know, the bigger point is to see woman as a vessel. It's really neat to look back at, certainly Greek mythology, but even Our Lady as an example of this. You know, if you look at the litany of, Loretto, or any of the litanies of her, there's all this mention of her as, you know, the Ark of the Covenant, or a vessel, or the seat of wisdom. You know, all these things carry something. The church does that. The church is known as the bark of Peter, you know, a ship. Even the building of the church, the architecture of it, is the main part of the church is called the nave, which refers to ship. It comes from the word navy, the Latin word root for all of that. So it's interesting to see that the feminine over and over and over again is that which carries things. Even the ocean, which of course moves things, is a she in Romance languages. So the home, of course, then becomes really an ultimate expression of woman, I think, in mm-hmm. so many ways. And, you know, I think so many of us, when we're busy, it doesn't feel like it's a reflection of us, because right. we're busy and we're just kind of throwing things together. But then when you slow down and you have some time to be very purposeful about it and put things where you want them and how you want them, then it suddenly starts to feel like an extension of you and an expression of you. And hopefully in a, you know, obviously a godly way, not in a way that's vain or narcissistic or, you know, preoccupation in a right. disordered way. But that's the beauty of when we have faith, is that we can decorate it with beautiful art and things that are going to call us back to God, instead of things that are going to just, you know, be mirrors of ourselves, literally mirrors, right, right. You know, all the way around the house.
And part of what people love so much is that this does draw them into a slower pace. And mm-hmm. as they're cultivating their home, as they're cultivating nature with gardening mm-hmm. or whatever it might be, you know, in a sense, although different, similar as well to men wanting to, you know, tinker with a car. They're wanting that mm-hmm. downtime, that rest for their brain from everything mm-hmm. else, for them to process. And sometimes we make the mistake of just running through all of our problems and all of our needs and just kind of, especially as women, obsessing over things. But in reality, this slower pace and the time it takes to do things, you know, just the idea of gardening alone, or of the slowness of being completely occupied, you know, sewing or mending something mm-hmm. and doing dishes, it really does lead us ultimately toward this opportunity for contemplation that yeah. is so easily missed if we're not intentional about having the silence in the midst of it.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's right. And I think it also points to just the beauty of the seasons as well. And that's one of the things that gardening is so poignantly points out is, you know, that there's a time when you can grow things and there's a time when you can't. And, you know, all of those elements are so pronounced, you can't force it to grow just because you want it to. It's, you know, you do everything right, but you have to wait for temperatures and for sunlight and, you know, all of those kinds of things. And it's a great reminder of just how our lives are meant to be that way rather than strictly functional, but that there really are seasons. But I think you're right about that piece of silence, that we can miss so much of it. If we don't know, if first of all, we have too much going on around us, whether it's television screens and, you know, all of those kinds of things.
Right.
But even just silencing our own worries and, you know, surrendering those to God and then being open, being open again, that idea of openness. I mean, then the natural element, the natural relationship that all humans, male or female, should have with God is one of receptivity, but mm-hmm. women even more so, because God really wants to plant spiritual ideas and seeds in our lives. And this is what we see so beautifully done in the lives of virgins and contemplative and cloistered women, of nuns, is that they have this openness, this radical relationship where these spiritual seeds are planted. And you can see that in someone like Mother Angelica. You know, mm-hmm. why is it that you have this cloistered nun who started the biggest Catholic television station in the United States, or really in the world?
Yeah.
You know, she had no idea what she was doing, but God mm-hmm. planted those seeds and helped that grow, and it came from silence. So that's the relationship with which we all should have oriented towards God, but especially towards women, because that's where the fruit is going to come in our lives, and that's where the real happiness is going to come from.
That's Dr. Carrie Grass joining Trending with Tim Murray here today during our weekly happy hour. We're going to come back talking about how sometimes we're just living on the surface and we don't realize what we're missing, how we're not going deeper in conversations, we're not going deeper into ourselves. We'll talk about that and so much more with Dr. Carrie Grass, the author of Theology of Home, The Anti-Mary Exposed. We'll be right back. Don't go away. Why are so many people struggling with mental health and suicide? This is Tim Murray from Trending with Tim Murray. Tuesday, I'll discuss how many people find themselves in the midst of two extremes, this idea of I am nothing, and then on the other side, this idea of being made for something special. We'll discuss how this controversy within the minds of many leads them to greater confusion if they don't have a God. Join me daily at 6 p.m. Central on Relevant Radio or the Relevant Radio app.
So, what's trending? Bridging your Catholic faith with your everyday life. You're listening to Trending with Tim Murray on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app.
Welcome to our weekly happy hour here on Trending. I'd love to hear your story. I shared one about the woman who missed the blessing from the Pope because she was trying to take a photo with her iPad. And so she was leaning away from the Pope as the Pope was reaching in to bless her right in front of me. So what have you ever missed? Perhaps a moment because you watched it through the phone with this insistence of taking a photo or a video. You're listening to Trending with Tim Murray. My guest today is Dr. Carrie Grass. She is author of the books Theology of Home 1 and 2, The Anti-Mary Exposed, among others. And I wanted to dive into this idea that you propose in your second book, A Theology of Home, having to do with living on the surface and how when we live on the surface, it can prevent us from going deeper into prayer, becoming more virtuous, becoming humble, but I would even argue from having deeper conversations and a better understanding of ourselves. So share with us a little bit of why you touched on that in your book. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I think partially because I just had some amazing experiences as a young woman of being kind of adopted by some different families that were big families and just amazing people. And kind of just diving into conversations that I never really had in my own family, or there were topics we didn't talk about. And it was just a fascinating dynamic to be a part of and to be engaged in and to recognize, you know, after I left those dinners and those meals, how edified I felt, how I felt I knew myself better. There was this quiet joy that I think I experienced from that kind of deep and rich community. So yeah, I think this is a vital part of our life, and it just becomes more and more fleeting because of the fact that we are so busy and we do have so many screens and we do have so many diversions and so many demands placed on us that it can be hard to sort of cordon time off and be very, you know, intentional about what you're doing and just spending time with the people that you love and having a conversation. I actually just got back from vacation with my family, and it was just amazing to have all this time together. You know, it was a challenge because there's five of us and we're traveling with an infant, but it was wonderful just to have a very different kind of scenery and an environment for us to be able to experience each other than, you know, just our regular daily lives, which of course, you know, we have a lot of, I homeschool, so my life hasn't changed that much because of COVID. So, you know, we have a lot of time together, but to do it in a different environment was
every homeschooled
really
mom's
blessing.
Like, welcome to the club.
Exactly. So yeah, no, not much has changed around here. Thankfully. Yeah, I know it can be really challenging though, especially if you aren't used to that pace of life, to just sort of slow down and take things in and sort of feel, and part of that is, as we write a lot about it in Theology of Home too, is we've been really taught that we're meant to be powerful or we're meant to be in control. And I think if anything, you know, this last year has really taught us that we are neither of those things in the face of broader issues, that we really are, there's this incredible fragility that we live with. And so that's the importance of really recognizing fruitfulness instead of power and control, because ultimately those things are going to be fleeting and not remotely fulfilling, whereas something like looking at the notion of fruitfulness and what it means in our lives, because we can't be fruitful without God. And that's just a key piece, is if we don't have that relationship and that connection with God, then we're not going to have fruitfulness, and ultimately that kind of happiness that we're looking for will always be elusive.
Let's talk about maybe some ways we can ponder the question of, am I living on the surface? You know, a couple things that come to mind as we're discussing, you know, am I bored when I'm having conversations? And sometimes, or perhaps am I talking about people rather than ideas? That's usually a big indicator that we're just living on the surface level. Another one I would say is, you know, are we constantly reaching for our phone to engage us? Are we picking it up out of a nervous habit or being uncomfortable, wanting entertainment? I think those, in my mind, are some of the top, you know, living on the surface level ideas. What comes to mind for you?
I think the biggest thing is just even the question of how comfortable are you in silence? And, you know, going to a place like adoration, you know, I think, I was trained very early on after my conversion to, you know, don't bring a book, just sit there and look at God and let God look at you. And, you know, it's just been an amazing journey since then. And to try and maintain that. But I think that if you're somebody, it's interesting, it's got harder after I had kids and I was so used to just being multitasking all the time. And then to have to go back into that, I was amazed at what a challenge it was, because it was something that I craved, but it was also something that I had, you know, it's really a habit and it's something that you have to build up to. So I think it can be discouraging to feel like I can't do that. Well, you can, it just takes time and just openness and kind of learning the task. So, you know, it's something that I had to sort of get back into, when I do have time to go to adoration, because it's so easy to just be multitasking and looking at the phone. So, that's another area. One thing that I know my husband and I did early on when I think we only had one child at this point, so it was a lot easier to do then, but, was we would invite friends over and we'd say, bring two questions with you. They can't be about politics. And, you know, we would just go around and talk about these different questions. And, you know, I think there were 10 of us. So by the end of the evening, we probably had gotten through like half of the questions, the multiple times that we did this. But it was just great, because I think so often we can also just really sink into that very superficial topics that we talk about people. Yes. You know, how many conversations have we had about COVID? Like, enough. Like, can we talk about something else, please?
Exactly. COVID was entertaining before it was known to be in the United States. Yeah. That was an idea. Yeah. Now it's just a torture to continue
yes.
to raid today.
Right. Do we still have to talk about it? So, yeah, I think maybe it's a great time to be talking about things that are non related to COVID or politics at this point. And I think it's those things, that those kinds of conversations, that end up being really interesting, because they're like threads that you start pulling on them. And then it just takes you to another area of interest and, you know, books that people have read or literature, you know, all those kinds of things can be talked about. So, yeah, that's another great way to go deeper too.
And I think that this is so helpful because, you know, moving to a new area over the last month and kind of starting to, you know, talk with people, you know, we know three people here so mm-hmm. far. And mm-hmm. it's been interesting when we've been around each other because Gabe and I are like, let's talk about ideas. Let's talk about, you know, and my husband's so good about asking a question about something. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're hungry for that conversation, that person-to-person conversation again of ideas and topics. And it's funny because someone commented, you know, I'm not really used to having these conversations very much. And all of a sudden they're noticing they want to sit for hours on end talking. And that can be new for some people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I think you're absolutely right because we just aren't used to doing it. And you can see it too, you know, in chat rooms and things like that. I mean, I'm always amazed at how quickly things devolve when you think you're having a conversation with somebody and the next thing you know, they're just emoting, you know, it's complete emotion, their anger, all of that versus reason and logic. And so we just aren't really trained in this way. And I don't think that needs to be daunting. I just think it needs to be one of those things where we can make a distinction between how I feel about something versus something that objectively is the case that doesn't have anything to do with us.
Right.
And that's an important place to start, that my emotions about something aren't always important.
Right.
So it's interesting. It's challenging.
Yeah. And it's interesting you say that because Karen, my producer, was just commenting that her husband went to a guy's night the other week and mm-hmm. they were asked by the host at the beginning of it about their wives. How long have you been married to their current wives? And, you know, a bunch of information came out, such as really, I think only a couple of them were still married to their first wives. And that's interesting because that very easily could turn into a conversation of emoting and past mm-hmm. experiences, or it could turn into, and I don't know what it turned into with the dudes, or it could turn into a conversation about the idea of marriage and what mm-hmm. are challenging concepts. What does it mean to be married? And I think this is especially challenging for women when a topic is brought up. Often we tend to kind of get into the weeds rather than getting into the idea and the philosophy mm-hmm. that mm-hmm. have the opportunity to grow us, but we sometimes miss that opportunity.
Mm-hmm. No, I think you're right. Especially if there's wounds there, it's very easy to get involved in that. And that's really the hard part. It's just, you know, rather than knowing how to find healing for those things, a lot of times we just feel like we have to just air the laundry again and tell everybody, and that somehow there's some kind of a sense of affirmation in that. And so, yeah, I think it's very hard, especially because, like you said, there's again that distinction between talking about people and talking about ideas. So, yeah, I think that's just a really great rule of thumb to sort of focus on the ideas and not so much the people, because you don't want it to involve or devolve into, you know, just a gossip session or, you know, a place where Kleenex needed to be brought out because somebody's rehashing what happened 15 years ago or whatever, you know, in that forum. So,
this is why I don't do women's things. Groups.
Yeah. Yes. No.
I'm sorry. I can't do it. Okay. So kind of back to the surface level idea. The great answer to that is silence, finding moments of silence throughout your day. And it doesn't mean you have to change necessarily what you're doing, just maybe how you're doing it. So where do you find silence? You know, you have your children, yet you find time to write, and writing in and of itself demands a ton of silence and mm-hmm. pondering. So share mm-hmm. with us a little bit what that's like for you.
Yeah, it was interesting. When I got married, we moved to a new area, and it's actually really transient area. There's a lot of people, it's a lot of military, and people just kind of move here for a year or two and then they move on somewhere else. And so, it was really challenging for me because I didn't have friends or any family close by, and, you know, I'd make friends and then they would move. And so I can really, you know, looking back, I can now see sort of the 7 years of my life where God was really kind of rewiring my interior, in pretty dramatic ways, because, you know, before that I was daily mass every day. I was in adoration every day. Like, I just had my routine down and I loved it. But all that came to kind of a screeching halt when I had children, because it was just, there were too many challenges in terms of how many there were and
time,
you know, yeah, exactly. And
And then add having to wear a mask if you go to church with a baby.
Yeah, no, and that's what I had a baby right before the lockdown. So yeah, it was just an amazing experience. Like, because I was so used to putting my mouth on the baby's head, like I can't feel you. So yeah, all those amazing new challenges. But I think that was really where I learned to pray differently. You know, I would pray when I would be up nursing at night. I would pray when I would be washing the dishes, that, you know, and not like rote prayers necessarily. Sometimes I would say the rosaries and things like that would work out really well. But like washing the dishes, I can't tell you how many insights I had washing the dishes. And I actually finished my doctorate during that time, my PhD during that time, while writing my dissertation. And it worked out great because I would write at night. And then the next day, you know, while I'm doing kind of mindless things, I was able to work through what I had to do the next night. So anyway, it was just an interesting time with really small children because there was a lot of silence, you know, throughout the day. But now, of course, that's changed a lot because I have a 12-year-old and, you know, 12, 10, 8, 6, and 1. So we have a lot of moving parts and I've kind of lost my evening silent time. So yet again, I think that's the beauty of seasons of life is God teaches us different ways to reach him and communicate with him. And exactly. And it's not a diminishment, but it's just made the roots go thicker for me.
And another season of life that you mentioned in your book is the challenge for empty nesters when their kids are gone. All of a sudden they find themselves back in the role of silence within the home, and it can become difficult. They're searching for distractions, they're searching for noises. Mm. How do you overcome that?
Yeah. And searching for meaning too. It was actually really interesting because I went to an appointment and I was talking with a dentist, and I had just found out I was pregnant, and he had just sent off his second child, last child, to college. And we realized we were the same age, and it was really a funny moment, but I could tell that there was kind of this sorrow. Like there was a sense, he didn't have a sense of meaning, you know, what am I going to do with my life? And, just based on our conversation, and it was really interesting. And I think that is one of the things that I get asked a lot about, you know, is what can I do? I'm at this stage. And I think that this is such an amazing time in terms of the prayer life where you can just turn that up and God is just going to shower you with so much fruit. Partially because you have time in a way that, you know, women with small children don't have time. So I think that's an exciting thing. The other exciting thing is just, and maybe I should need to put together like a book list of like the top 100 books that women should be reading, you know, if they have time. Because I can look over and I have probably about 75 books next to my bed.
I can tell you're looking over there.
Yes, things I need to be reading or would love to be reading. And I just don't have time to do. And that are just so rich. I mean, there's something so dramatically different about diving into a long, deep book versus, you know, binge watching, you know, Downton Abbey or something. Like,
or even just bouncing from article to article or a long Instagram post on how to cook something. Completely. It's like you want something deeper. You can't quite chew on something if you don't get the full meal.
And take it with you and have it transform you. And I think that's, you know, the excitement of a well-written book is that it should transform you. It should stay with you. So anyway, I think that it can be a very challenging time because there's just so much that changes. But again, it's not a season that God hasn't prepared you for and doesn't have plans for. You know, this isn't the place where you have nothing to do. In fact, if anything, he's going to give you more because you have more time in a way that, you know, women with small children don't. So anyway, I think it would be, I'm very happy with the stage of life I'm at right now, but boy, am I looking forward to getting back into books again.
The pondering it again. That's Dr. Carrie Gress here on Trending with Tim Marie. Check out some of her latest work, Theology of Home, Theology of Home 2. I especially recommend the second one for some real meat in terms of the content of what we are as women. Who are we? So go ahead and check them out at theologyofhome.com. And I'll be back in just a little bit here during our weekly happy hour to talk about how you can quit sugar and how it'll make you happier. Most of us are addicted. Are you? We'll be right back. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/forester.
Bridging your Catholic faith with your everyday life. You're listening to Trending with Timory on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app.
Are you addicted to sugar? I know I have been in the past. It's something I'm struggling with yet again with a baby. I wouldn't say I'm addicted to it now, but it's I want more of it and I want more. But I think that just comes with Lent. You know, you have this plan, you know, in general, we're not just supposed to be giving something up. We're supposed to be engaging in prayer, fasting, almsgiving. But traditionally in the history of the church, you cut out sugar. You cut out the extra things in addition to what you give up, in addition to your hardcore fasting, in addition to the almsgiving and the prayer. And so we're going to talk about giving up sugar, some tips for how to do that. But before we go there, I want to talk about this idea of suffering and prayer. I was reading a couple weeks ago about how often people who pray have a higher number of health issues. And I thought that was fascinating. People who pray have a higher number of health issues. And I was pondering it in relation to this idea that you hear Catholics say all the time of offer it up. I remember one summer, it was when I was kind of at some of the peak of my autoimmune disease, and I was really struggling. And I remember there was one lovely Catholic in my life. I was out of state in a different area, and I couldn't eat anything. I wasn't keeping any food down. And at the time, we didn't know beyond my food allergies what was wrong. But I remember the person just kept saying, offer it up, offer it up. At a certain point, I wanted to strangle her every time she said, offer it up, as I'm like, I've had 2 bites of almond butter in the last 2 days. I do not have an eating disorder. I am sick. Please don't tell me to offer it up again. And trust me, there were a lot of opportunities to pray at the time. I was actually living the summer with a religious order and was going through this formation program with them. And from that point on, the idea of offering it up, I became really cautious about saying that because I remember how annoyed I was at the time. But at the same time, asceticism is an important part of our religious tradition. The idea of behavior modification, of making an offering to God. Now, we can make a sacrifice. We could choose to fast for 3 days, let's say, but it could make us a really ugly person and we're an absolute jerk to everyone around us. So would you say that God was calling you to that fasting? Perhaps not. In fact, I believe it's St. John Vianney is the one who Satan used to mock, because St. John Vianney would have this potato thing where he'd only eat potatoes. And so when the devil would see him, he'd mock him. He was a potato eater and he'd call him the potato eater. Why? Because sometimes the sacrifices that we make can actually be something we're not called to. Something that may or may not be good for our growth, but God can work even in the midst of a sacrifice we take on upon ourselves to perfect us through that improper sacrifice we're making. But as I'm thinking about this idea of how supposedly people who pray more have more health issues, I wonder if part of it is that God is allowing you, in the midst of your attempt to grow closer to Him, to suffer more. Not just mentally, not just emotionally, but physically. That God is permitting physical pain so that we can unite ourselves to Him. That we can choose, Lord, okay, I don't feel good right now, but in the midst of it, I can still be charitable to the people in my home. I don't feel good right now, but in the midst of it, I can offer this small sacrifice, as small or as great as it may be, that God permits His loved ones to suffer. And if you read in much of the early church, God's friends, His disciples, were not treated very well. If you think about it, what happened to all of His apostles except for John, the beloved apostle? They died a bloody martyr's death. Think about most of the early church saints. Taken into exile. Killed. I mean, we could go on and on. So many of our saints were killed. They didn't die peacefully. They died peacefully in their soul, but not physically. God permits those whom he loves to suffer. And in fact, this is all over the New Testament books, especially the epistles. Read St. Paul. Read 1 Peter. Read James. Read John. Look it. They often talk about how God allows for this trial. But we don't like it. In fact, we hate it. And we beg God to take our trials away from us. But prayer changes us if we unite our prayer with our suffering. Are you willing to unite that suffering, small or big that it may be, with God? To quote unquote, offer it up. Not just saying, well, I'll embrace the suck. Because I think that's a problem when Catholics say, let me just embrace the suck. Because this is my life. My life sucks. This is happening. That's happening. God allowed it, so let's just embrace it. No. Unite yourself with God through it. There's a major difference between the idea of embracing the suck and saying, no, I can be a good person. Goodness is a virtue. Charity is a virtue. Patience is a virtue. Get this one. Peace is a virtue. How do we have peace in the midst of physical suffering? I've seen a lot of people who have had tremendous joy, peace, hope, and be incredibly charitable even in the face of the suffering that they are going through. Just look to the saints. They show this in a very profound way. Perhaps we need to ponder the stories of the saints more often to be reminded that this momentary agony that we are suffering, even if it's prolonged for a time, can bring about even greater purity of faith in each of us. So is suffering a bad thing? A Catholic take on it? No. But what do you and I need to do in order to get ourselves there as well? You're listening to Trending with Timory. I want to talk about quitting sugar. So many of us are addicted to sugar. And if you say you aren't, but you eat candy daily, you put scoops of sugar in your coffee in the morning, you have maybe dessert every single day and go back for seconds. If you just suck that one piece of candy throughout the day, you eat chocolate throughout the day. I mean, these are just a handful of things. Cookies, yes, cookies, Karen. There's so many things. I don't know. What is it for you? It might even just be that granola that you love, that you think you're being really great because you're having granola. But in actuality, go look at the back of the box. You're eating sugar. You're not eating granola, okay? Same with the cereal. Same with the sodas. And we could go through a litany of things that we are just going through that are really just feeding our sugar craving. A lot of people don't realize that sugar brings mental fog. It can contribute to anger. Of course, we choose to act on our anger, but it can contribute to anger, confusion. It can impact so many things. And I find that every single health issue out there today, oh, cut back on your sugar, cut back on your sugar. But at what point are we going to actually start cutting back on our sugar? Yes, Reese's Pieces, anything. Oh man, before I like gave up sugar, Reese's Pieces covered apples. Like if you make your own homemade caramel apples, okay, just don't go home and try it because it's Lent, but maybe for Easter, that's a really, really good thing to try. I'm just saying, my mouth is watering. So here are some things you can do to quit sugar. One, you have to be willing to do it. And then two, you have to make a plan, like anything. Maybe even acknowledge the fact that you might be addicted to sugar. I recommend starting to fast. Or in those moments, you can actually choose something to offer up your sugar craving for. Instead of having it, maybe there's someone in your life. Maybe there's a petition that you really need. Every single time you want to go for that cookie, go for the candy. Say, Lord, I'm offering this desire for this person. And I'm letting go of my attachment to the sugar. Some practical tips. Get some sugar-free electrolytes. I'm not talking about the crappy sugar, something with stevia, stevia leaf extract. It's not bad for you. Drink your sweet electrolytes. Have a piece of low glycemic fruit, berries maybe. But you have the ability to make changes and sugar's one opportunity. Why are so many people struggling with mental health and suicide? This is Tim Murray from Trending with Tim Murray. Tuesday, I'll discuss how many people find themselves in the midst of two extremes, this idea of I am nothing, and then on the other side, this idea of being made for something special. We'll discuss how this controversy within the minds of many leads them to greater confusion if they don't have a God. Join me daily at 6 p.m. Central on Relevant Radio or the Relevant Radio app.